You are listening to Gangland Wire, true stories from the mouths of the men who either committed these crimes, investigated these crimes, or reported on the crimes. Hosted by former Kansas City Police Intelligence Unit Detective Gary Jenkins. Well, good afternoon, all you wiretappers. Today, we're going to talk about one of my favorites, Roy Albert DeMayo. Roy Albert DeMayo would eventually become a made man in the Gambino crime family. Plus, on top of that, in my opinion, he was probably actually a serial killer. Roy DeMayo will live on and on in mob lore for the deeds of the DeMayo crime crew. Two of his most feared crew members will live on, and a lot of you guys have heard of this, the Gemini Twins. Roy DeMayo would buy a joint in Brooklyn at 4021 Flatlands Avenue. Now, matter of fact, this building is still there. If you live in New York, you want to go by and see it. And in kind of an ironic twist, it's now the Purpose Life Church. They would name this the Gemini Lounge. And the Gemini Lounge and the kitchen and back rooms would be more like the killing floor of a slaughterhouse, except they killed and butchered human beings instead of pigs. If you remember that Sopranos episode where I think Tony's sister had killed her lover, Richie, they took Richie's body down there and they had to disappear Richie and then claim that he went in the witness protection program. They took Richie's body down to Satriel's pork store where they had all the usual butchering tools and ways to get rid of packaged meat and all that and a table. He directed his crew to put on aprons and cut up Richie's body and just like it was a whole hog, wrap it up in packages. Well, I think maybe they probably had read up on Roy DeMayo whoever the writer was that created that scene. The FBI would claim that the DeMayo crew was probably responsible for as many as 200 or 300 murders from the mid-1970s up into the 1980s. The DeMayo crew was described by many law enforcement officers as the deadliest and most feared mafia crew of the five families in New York during this time. Law enforcement officers, informants, reporters, anybody that really had anything to do with the DeMayo crew would describe this crew as sadistic homicidal maniacs. Those crazy killers, ice-cold murders maniacs, lethal animals, barbaric psychopaths, brutal psychopath killers. Obviously, they were some bad dudes and more than just your regular criminals. Law enforcement at the time estimated the DeMayo crew contained as many as 40 men, and each one of them was trying to outdo the others to be the most ruthless, bloodthirsty, or psychopathic killer. Well, let's see where Roy DeMayo came from. Like many mob guys, he was born into a working-class family. He was born in Brooklyn, in the Flatlands area of Brooklyn, and he really never left this neighborhood. He started out as a teenager running a loan sharking operation for his fellow high school students. He fell in with a mob guy and did a little collecting for him, so he got indoctrinated into mob life early on. He would graduate from James Madison High School in 1959. Like many of these mob guys, always kind of amazes me. He'll get married, start having children, have a wife and family, which he takes care of and seems to care a lot about on one hand, but then on the other hand, he's a psychopathic killer. All this time while he was married, he started out with kind of a regular square john job, but he continued his criminal ways of earning a living until he could finally ditch that job and devote his entire life to being a criminal. He kind of naturally gravitated to the Carnese area of Brooklyn, which was adjacent to the Flatbush area. This area was depicted as the site of the Bamboo Lounge where Jimmy the Gent Burke and Henry Hill and that crew hung out, if you saw the Goodfellas movie or read the book. This whole area was in a state of change, and there were many immigrants coming in from the West Indies during this time, so there was a little bit of rubbing up between West Indian immigrants and the Italian immigrants who were now the native sons. There was a Gambino soldier operating in this area, and Anthony Nino Gaggi. Well, Nino took notice of young Roy DeMayo. When he learned about DeMayo's success as a young loan shark, in collection, he recruited him to be an associate in the Gambino crime family and work for him. DeMeo continued loan sharking, and Nino Gaggi would give him money to put on the street. For DeMeo, this access to a made mob guy was allowed him to recruit more young men, have more connections to loan out more money, make more vig from off the streets. He also branched out with his newly found kind of success and stature as an associate of a made guy. He branched out with his crew into car theft and drug trafficking. Now, Roy DeMeo had a high school friend named Chris Rosenberg. Now, Chris became the first member of what later would become known as the DeMeo crew. At this time, Rosenberg was hanging out at a popular Carnese gas station, and he was basically a street drug dealer. Roy had some connections, and he had money. So he invested it into his friend, and Rosenberg started buying narcotics in larger amounts, and he eventually made himself a narcotic wholesaler with street dealers working for him. This was kind of Roy's first foray into the drug business and finding out just how lucrative it was. In the early 1970s, during this time, Chris Rosenberg introduced some of his friends to Roy, and it seemed like they had what it took to work with Roy. They were cold-blooded enough and hard enough men, Roy would recruit them to be his crew. The core members of this crew would become Roy's cousin and a guy, you'll find out later why they called this guy Dracula, Joseph Guglielmo, Joseph Testa, Anthony Center, and Joseph Testa's younger brother, Patrick Testa. One of Roy's first more sophisticated crimes, if you will, he had joined the Borough of Brooklyn Credit Union. And using influence from the Gambino crime family, he was able to gain a position on the board of directors of this credit union. A credit union is like a bank. They got a whole lot of money in there. Plus, it was a valuable connection for DeMeo to launder his illegal profits from gambling or loan sharking and stolen car racket, drug dealing. He would eventually influence other employees or get employees put in place that would help other New York drug dealers launder their money. He kind of became, you know, known in a certain segment of the population as the guy to go to launder your drug money, because that's always the biggest problem for a drug dealer is, what do I do with all this cash money? Once he got on the board of directors, he was also able to get access to their cash reserves, and he would put that money out on the streets in his loan sharking business. During this time, he maintained a cover job as a salesman for a Brooklyn company called the S&C Sportswear Corporation. He would always claim he owned a variety of different businesses, was in the construction business, that he owned a restaurant, and also was in the used car business. Roy DeMeo quickly and easily was brought into the mafia tradition of Omerta, and he adopted his own personal code. His code was like most mob guys. He would never cooperate with authorities. I remember Nick Savella here in Kansas City. He would never even speak to authorities. I mean, anybody even spoke to him or did anything, he was not happy with them. He always maintained self-control in the face of adversity, at least on the surface. Now, down underneath, once he got into a private place with you and you were being some kind of a burr under his saddle, he did not maintain self-control. He was willing to carry out a vendetta to avenge any slight suffered by his crime family and probably his blood family, more likely be his crime family. Plus, he never forgot any deed that he characterized that was bad for him or anybody in his crime family. He easily and readily bought into the idea that he was part of the Gambino crime family, and he eagerly kicked up to Nino Gaggi. You know, some say this percentage can be as much as an equal share to what all the members of the crew got from a particular score. So if there's four guys on a score, then each one got 25%, or maybe the guy that set it up got a little bigger percentage, and if he went along on the job too. But they basically got a share of the score, and he would kick up probably as much as an equal share as if Nino Gaggi went right along with the score. Well, by age 32, Roy DeMeo was living in a pretty expensive home with his wife and children. And as I said before, it's always one of the things I find interesting about these mob guys. They have this nice home and children, all of whom will usually go to parochial school. The wife will be a homemaker. Dad will then go out and go into the city and be the enforcer of mob rules. He'll commit his first murders for the Gambinos during this time. He and Nino Gaggi are extorting money from a lucrative X-rated film business. Now, this was one of his first problems that he really showed what he was made of. The owner, the guy that was the victim of their extortion plot, Paul Rothenberg, got arrested during a police investigation into his X-rated film business. And Nino and Roy became convinced that Rothenberg will turn on him and start snitching and maybe become a witness and give him up to the cops. So Roy sets him up. He asks Rothenberg to meet. Let's have dinner. Let's talk about how we're going to pay your legal fees for this arrest. They both arrived at this diner about the same time and exited their cars. Probably Roy got there a little bit early and waited. And as soon as he got there, and when he got out, Roy got out, walked up to him, produced a gun equipped with a silencer, and pulled him off into a nearby alley. Shot him several times in the head, just left his body there, walked back, got in his car, and drove off just like nothing happened. Nobody particularly saw what happened. If you kept the gun kind of out of, down, you know, underneath your coat, just kind of open it up, kind of out of sight, and kept it down low, nobody noticed the gun. The guy, you know, what's the guy going to do? What he should have done is just start running and fighting right there. Don't ever let him take you somewhere. Somebody confronts you with a gun and they want you to go somewhere else. Don't ever let them take you there. I say, you know, kill me here now, dude, or you ain't going to take me anywhere else. Now, it's said that Roy was kind of surprised himself at how easy he killed this man and how he could just look at this murder as being just part of his business. This is just business. Not personal, it's just business, as they say. He'd like to tell his underlings, once you do this one time, you can do anything. You can do it again and again. It'll bother you less and less. During the next few years, Roy DeMeo will train his crew to kill without question whenever he gave the order. You know, in kind of a macabre twist, Roy DeMeo, who had once been a butcher's apprentice, will train these same crew members in the art of dismembering a body so they can easily dispose of it. Now let's talk about the Gemini Lounge. I mentioned the Gemini Lounge and the Gemini Twins before. Around 1974, Roy DeMeo bought a two-story. Roy DeMeo bought a two-story building in Flatbush, Brooklyn. It had a bar called Phil's Lounge in it at the time, and one of his crew members, it'll probably be lost to history who it was, they renamed it the Gemini Lounge. This would become the headquarters for all of DeMeo crew's future legal activities and many murders. Joy Testa and Anthony Center, I mentioned the Gemini Twins. They became known as the Gemini Twins. They were some of his main killers and dismemberers of bodies. These guys recruited another stone killer named Henry Borelli. Kind of like the Jimmy Burke crew meeting at the Bamboo Lounge all the time, most every night. The DeMeo crew came in here almost every day where they socialized, drank, ate, planned scores, critiqued past scores, gossiped, and did all the human activities that any, you know, guys going to work would do. But instead of just going into the plant or to the office, this was the mafia crew at their social club. DeMeo was kind of a gun nut, and he collected an impressive arsenal of machine guns, automatic rifles, and silencers, kept them in a storage room at the lounge. He also installed his cousin, the guy I mentioned before, Dracula, Joseph Dracula Guglielmo. He put Dracula into an adjoining apartment in the same building. This is kind of a security procedure. We had this in Kansas City. They would, wherever the social club was, where they always met, if there was a way to have an apartment real close to it or right over it, they will put somebody in there to live there. It's kind of a security procedure. It really helps prevent the cops or the FBI from breaking in and going through books or records or planning listening devices. You can get it done still, but it just makes it a lot harder. You got to get that guy out of there. In 1974, the DeMeo crew was selling cars and selling the chop shops. Besides, they had another, they would develop into a little more lucrative, more sophisticated car theft operation. But at first, you know, you start out, you buy them, you steal them, kind of steal them to order. Find a chop shop that needs a, you know, front clip for a 74 Lincoln, or needs some green doors for a Cadillac, and a trunk lid, left rear fender, that kind of thing. Find that car and steal it. They got in a dispute with one of their body shop owners, a guy named Andrea Katz. Shortly after, a crooked cop informed Roy that Katz was snitching on them. A month later, Roy takes care of this business. He has Joseph Testa and Henry Borelli lure Katz to a place where they can snatch him up unobserved. Now, Roy, mob reporter Jerry Capisi will debrief a source who had some access to firsthand knowledge about this, and he got the following description. Capisi will call this the Night of the Knives. Capisi claims that Chris Rosenberg was there, and he killed Katz by stabbing him several times in the heart and in the back with a butcher knife. The DeMeo crew, just like the Sopranos, DeMeo crew put on their butcher aprons and started dismembering the body, just like Roy had taught him, the old butcher's apprentice. And Rosenberg, he always wanted to go a step further and look like the baddest guy. He was kind of insecure, I think. And he wanted to pulverize Andrea Katz's head, so he put it in a compacting machine. After they dismembered the body parts, they would wrap it in butcher paper and put it in a green trash bag for disposal. And they dumped the, and in this case, this was one of their early operations. They dumped these, all these bags in the same nearby garbage bin to be hauled away. Well, they dumped it a little bit too early. And before the trash truck arrived to haul the body parts away, a homeless guy comes by. He's looking for food, starts digging in there and thinking, well, hey, man, I found me a bunch of meat in here or something. He unwraps some of these green trash bags and starts finding body parts. He goes and calls the police. They said the crime scene investigators would find 8 neatly wrapped packages. It was claimed they never found Katz's genitals. I don't know. That's probably a rumor that they put on the street, or, you know, maybe they just threw them away. I don't know. I don't know what that means, but it scares the shit out of me. I know that. When this hit the newspapers, there was a young woman who had assisted in setting Katz up, and she knew she had. She started talking to people, and cops found out about her, got her in, and she gave a statement. So they were all charged with murder. But they went to trial, and they were found not guilty at trial. There was they had a pretty good one, at least one of their lawyers, a very skillful defense lawyer, and he was able to discredit this witness and tie her all up and get the jury to doubt that she really knew what she was talking about. Many times the people like this that are involved in and around these people, they do not make the best witnesses. Many times they're drug addicts, and they're hard to find when it comes time for trial. I've had that. Many times they're really inarticulate, or they're just scared, or they have this. They're doing so many drugs, all of a sudden they really can't remember, or they don't really want to remember. So anyhow, they're really poor witnesses. I know that. This is probably, in my opinion, it's probably one of the very first murders of this type committed by the DeMeo crew, and probably the first one to use dismemberment as a tool to dispose of the evidence. Several years later, there's a Bonanno underboss named Salvatore Vitale, and he claimed he had delivered a dead body to Roy DeMeo and his crew about the same time. He claimed he stood there and watched as DeMeo and several members of his crew dismembered this corpse. So that might have been the first, but we don't even know exactly who that was. They did learn a lesson from this screw-up about finding the body parts. Afterwards, they got a method down. They always cut the bodies into 6 parts, and then they packaged them up in the butcher paper, and then wrapped them in the plastic bags, and then they dumped each package in a different place. Supposedly, there was a mountainous garbage dump just across the highway from the housing complex in Starrett City, which is a housing development in Brooklyn, and they used that quite a little bit. DeMeo was kind of a perfectionist in these grisly tasks. I guess goes back to his butcher's apprentice training, his work ethic. He directed his crew members to form a disassembly line of butchers. You've heard of an assembly line. This is the disassembly line. They had a regular procedure. They would lure their unsuspecting victim to the Gemini Lounge, acting like they're his buddy, being all nice, put them at ease, buy them drinks, get them something to eat, keep them drinking there until late at night. So remember that. You got somebody that seems kind of unusual, and they want to buy you a lot of drinks and keep you in a joint till late at night. If they're these kind of people, get out now. Once the coast was cleared and the civilians were out of the Gemini Lounge, they'd lock the door, kill the dude, and then take him in the back where they had the disassembly line. Pretty soon he'd be neatly wrapped in 5 to 6 brown butcher paper wrappers and stuff them into garbage bags and distribute your body all over Brooklyn. 1976, Roy DeMeo was 36 years old. This was kind of an important year for him. Carlo Gambino, the boss of the Gambino family, would die. The new boss of the Gambino family was Big Paul Castellano. Now, the person closest to Castellano was Nino Gaggi. And if you remember, he was Roy DeMeo's mentor from early on in his mob days. Nino had also been the capo of the DeMeo crew. Roy DeMeo had always been a good earner for Nino, which is a good thing. Especially because Big Paulie Castellano really did not like Roy. They said he even despised Roy, and here's why. Because his heritage was not from Sicily. His ancestors were from Naples. Big Paul always considered Neapolitans as unreliable. But he was making money for Nino, and Nino was close to Castellano, so Nino just kept putting in a good word for him and kept him going. DeMeo had a really strong sense of duty, and he also had kind of an overachieving attitude about his position in the mob. He felt less than, and he wanted to prove that he could be as good as any Sicilian. He desired more than anything to become a made man. This is one of the reasons he became this complete killing machine. He believed this would help him earn his button. Making money was probably a better way and another way to earn your way into the good graces of the boss and to get made. Now, Paul Castellano had heard a lot of stories about DeMeo and his crew, and Paul was a little bit conservative, and actually that's what got him in trouble. Paul was not as much of a street guy, did not hang out with the street guys, did not go into social clubs, stayed in his mansion, kind of wanted to get more into white-collar crime and less out of the street crime, you know, and where you have to rub up against other criminals, robbing drug dealers and even actually auto theft and all the different street crimes that these guys would do to make money. And that's part of the reason why Gotti wanted him dead. And Gotti also wanted him dead so he could take over the Gambino crime family. But Paul Castellano did not want any cowboys in his family. He didn't want anybody who might go off and kill somebody just for the hell of it, just because over some personal vendetta or personal revenge thing. He once told Nino that he promised he would never make Roy DeMeo a member of the Gambino family. Now, during this time, DeMeo believed really all he had to do was be a good soldier, do what he was told, earn a lot of money from the family, and he would eventually get made. And he did have a pretty good work ethic, and he was a canny criminal. He was a good negotiator. He knew how to make money. He redoubled his efforts in shylocking and the stolen car racket, increased that. We'll talk a little more about the stolen car racket because that gets exposed. Now, at this time in Manhattan, there was an Irish mob, which were always rubbing up against the Italians in many ways. They had a leader, longtime leader. We did a show on it, on Mickey Spillane, and he was being difficult about the Gambino crime family and not allowing them or being a kind of a thorn in their side to keep them from operating in Manhattan. Well, Roy DeMeo saw this, and he saw an opening. He forged a relationship with an upstart leader of the Westies, a guy named Jimmy Coonan. Well, in May 1977, Roy and one of his crew members, Edward Grillo, murdered Mickey Spillane, and this allowed his friend, Jimmy Coonan, and Jimmy Coonan's lieutenant, Mickey Featherstone, to become the top criminal figures on the West Side in the Irish gangs. Roy informed Nino Gaggi of the possibilities of partnership between the Westies and the Gambino family, because he had this connection to Jimmy Coonan, and he is the one responsible for getting Jimmy promoted, shall we say. So they set up a meet with Paul Castellano between Coonan and this Mickey Featherstone. At this meeting, Paul Castellano made him an offer that they couldn't refuse, I would assume. The Westies, they told Coonan that they could now be a de facto arm of the Gambino crime family, but in return, they had to agree to share 10% of all their profits, and everybody had to be able to operate in Manhattan. And in exchange, the Westies would get part of some really good union deals, like the Jacob Javits Center construction project going on at the time, and a lot of good union contracts to be let for connected companies. And they also agreed they would do any murder contracts that the Italians asked them to do. But this action here actually impressed Big Paul with Roy DeMeo and his money-making and deal-making ability. Now, he didn't see him as a cowboy here. He saw him as a deal-maker and a guy that can make money in a more sophisticated way than going out and beating people up and killing them in any kind of street crimes. Paul opened the books up. Nino once again put up Roy's name for the status of a made man. Big Paul refused at first, but eventually he relented, and Roy DeMeo got his button. He was a made man in the Gambino crime family. He pledged his allegiance to Omerta, the Sicilian Code, and knew that there was no getting out of this alive. Roy DeMeo increased his stolen car operation to the point where it was paying off as much as $30,000 a week. Now, I imagine Big Paulie Castellano liked that. All these mob bosses, and you make money, they like it. Just don't draw too much attention or heat. He had his crew out stealing cars and paying other people to steal cars on order, and they were shipping them overseas where no one would check the VIN. The FBI got onto this and opened a case known as the Empire Boulevard Operation. During the summer of 1980, federal and state agents raided a warehouse serving as DeMeo's headquarters for the stolen car racket. Longtime DeMeo crew members Henry Borelli and Frederick DeNome were arrested at this time and charged for their roles in the operation. DeMeo was not charged, and he ordered Borelli and DeNome to plead guilty to these charges. This would stop any further investigation into the conspiracy as long as they held their water and kept their mouths shut. Now we're getting pretty close to the end of Roy DeMeo's career, but before we hear about Roy's final demise, I got to go down the Iceman path. I know there's a lot of arguments and supposition about the Iceman, whose real name was Richard Kuklinski. He dropped out of school in the eighth grade, best I can tell. He would become a full-time criminal, stealing cars and robbing houses in Jersey City and Hoboken. He was from the Northeast area. Now, he claims he became a serial killer and a mafia hitman. There's a video out there, an interview that he did while he was in prison. There's been a book written about him by a guy that was a pretty well-known author. I don't really want to further his claim to fame myself. I feel like I really have to mention it. And here's why I don't even want to say anything more about him. He claims he was involved in the kidnapping and murder of Jimmy Hoffa. He claims he was involved in the murder of Carmine Galante. And he also claims to be involved in the murder of Paulie Castellano. If he was really involved in that stuff, especially those three ones, and especially the Paul Castellano, there was more investigation went into that than you can shake a stick at. And Jimmy Hoffa, come on, give me a break. Now, he did claim that he murdered homeless men in the New York City area for years just to see what it'd feel like. Now, I know he claims that he got heavily in debt to Roy DeMeo, or somebody's partnered up with Roy DeMeo and DeMeo pistol whipped him. But supposedly, the story that the Iceman told was he would become a hitman and enforcer for Roy DeMeo. He claims that Roy DeMeo took him out. He went into the Gemini Lounge. He was in debt. He went in the Gemini Lounge and confronted Roy. And Roy admired his chutzpah so much that he took him out and he said, well, I could do something with you. And they drove driving down the street and he said, kill that guy. And he said, I just got out and went up and killed this guy. And from then on, I was able to do killings for the Gambino crime family. I don't really believe it. He might have been pistol whipped by Roy DeMeo because he owed some money, but I don't really know. Probably the closest he came to organized crime was he was bootlegging copies of X-rated movies, and he was copying, and he had some connection to the X-rated film business. I don't know. Maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe he's a real deal serial killer, maybe he wasn't. I don't really believe any of it. Let me know what you guys think about that. I'll post this on Facebook, Gangland Wire Facebook page, and a link to this, and make comments about what you think about the Iceman and his connection to Roy DeMeo and the Gambino crime family. Now, as I said before, the FBI was starting to pay a lot of attention to Roy DeMeo and the DeMeo crew, and of course they would have known. Of course, they would have known about the Gemini Lounge. You would pick up a lot of those stories. And they found that there was quite a large number of missing or bodies had been found but missing mob guys who were linked to Roy DeMeo. They were listening. They had a microphone in the home of a Gambino family member, Angelo Ruggiero. And they heard Angelo and Gene Gotti, John Gotti's brother, talking about Paul Castellano and how Paul was mad at DeMeo. And he put a hit out on him, probably something to do with this Chris Rosenberg deal, bringing so much heat down on that. He put a hit out on him, and he couldn't find anybody that was willing to do the job. Gene Gotti even said that his brother John Gotti was a little bit afraid of him. He believed that John Gotti thought that DeMeo had an army, what he called an army of killers around him. I think that's a direct quote from the wiretap. And they also agreed that Roy DeMeo had killed probably 38 or 39, maybe 40 men, while John Gotti may have killed 10, if he even killed that many. Big Polly finally got his underboss, Frank DeCiccio, who was mentioned in the Gaspipe Casso story, to take the contract. But he couldn't. But DeCiccio couldn't get to DeMeo. And as I said, and I mentioned before, if you can't trick somebody, if they're paranoid and they think they're in trouble, you're not going to be able to isolate them. You're going to have to cowboy it. Nobody likes to cowboy these shootings, especially you think like in a crowded city like New York City where there's so many innocent bystanders around. It's just really hard to, even late at night, I've been there 4 o'clock in the morning, you walk down the street and there'll be 20 other people in the block. DeCiccio figured out how to do it, though. This guy was pretty sharp. What you got to do is recruit DeMeo's own men, which by this point in time, it probably wasn't that hard to do. His son, Albert DeMeo, in his book will say that during these last days, Roy was paranoid. He knew he was marked for execution. He knew that his time was up. He said his father had considered, that Roy had considered faking his own death and leaving the country, but that's, you know, that isn't how these mob guys go out. I can't think of the last, I don't know of a mob guy that ever did that. I know Nick Savella once inquired about getting a fake ID. He had a conversation in the penitentiary visiting room that was bugged about if you get a fake ID from somebody, Mexican out in California, he could travel around on that, but they never did do it. Finally, one day, Roy DeMeo left his home, and he left his watch, wallet, and ring. On that day, Roy DeMeo went to one of his underlings' body shop. It was reported that he was wearing a leather jacket, and he had a shotgun concealed underneath it, hanging around by a strap, probably around his neck, a sawed-off shotgun. That was January 10th, 1983. On January the 18th, 1983, Roy DeMeo's body was found in the trunk of his car. The autopsy revealed he'd been shot multiple times. He had entry wounds in his hands as if he had thrown up his hands in defense. The government suspected that his old mentor and boss, Nino Gaggi, probably is the one who set him up, probably got him to go to that place, although he was still suspicious. He may have even been the man who was there to greet him and killed him. There were other people who would report, other informants would report that his former crew members, Joseph Testa and Anthony Center, were there and maybe they killed him. Gaggi was not charged with the murder. He would die of a heart attack a few years later at age 62. Now, according to Gaspipe, Anthony Gaspipe Casso, he was given this contract by John DeCiccio and John Gotti, and he was the one that was able to hire Joseph Testa and Anthony Center and to do this murder, and Nino Gaggi wasn't present at all. And over the next few months, after Roy gets killed, the core members of his crew, Henry Borelli and Joseph Testa and Anthony Center, were in prison for life. They actually charged them with a total of 25 murders. Also, probably continuing criminal enterprise, extortion, car theft, drug trafficking. These convictions were secured in large part from testimony by former crew members who, if you remember, one of the guys that got arrested in the stolen car operation, Frederick DeNome. Then another guy, Dominic Montalio. I don't know him or who he was. He was probably part of that stolen car operation. The FBI had indicted Paul Castellano at this point in time for ordering the murder of DeMaio, must have had him on a wire, as well as other crimes, but he'd be killed by John Gotti in 1985, December of 1985, at Sparks Steakhouse as he was getting ready to go inside for a sit-down. John Gotti would then, of course, become the boss of the Gambino crime family. And we all know what happened to John Gotti, who's now dead of natural causes. Thus ends a story about one of the most feared killers in the entire five families in New York City. Roy Albert DeMaio rivaled Albert Anastasia in his Murder Incorporated. He was kind of like Henry Hill. He started in high school running errands for a mob-associated loan shark, started getting his own little pieces of action. Throughout the 60s, 70s, and 80s, he lived the dream. He lived his dream anyhow. He became a Gambino family crime associate. He became a maid member, became the leader of his own crew. He earned millions for himself, for his men, for his bosses, Carlo Gambino, then Paul Castellano, and his mentor, Nino Gaggi. And in the end, he died a real mobster's death in a hail of bullets fired by his friends after being set up by his friends. I'd like to thank the National Crime Syndicate and Gangsters Incorporated bloggers for their research. You might be interested to know that Roy DeMaio's son, Albert DeMaio, wrote a book about his father. This book received many positive Amazon reviews, so I probably could recommend it. The name of the book is For the Sins of My Father, a Mafia Killer, His Son, and the Legacy of a Mob Life. Now, time for my public service announcement, I think. If you have a friend or relative that has a problem with drugs or alcohol, make your first call to First Call. Call 816-361-5900 or go to their website, www.firstcallkc.org. And as always, I thank you for listening to my podcast. If you have iTunes, please give me a review. If you enjoyed what you hear and would like to support this podcast, please go to my website, www.ganglandwire.com. Then hit the donate button. Or you might buy one of my DVDs. You know, I produced this documentary, Gangland Wire, and also wrote a companion book, Leaving Vegas, How FBI Wiretaps Ended Mob Domination of Las Vegas Casinos. These works document the Kansas City mob and skimming from Las Vegas casinos. And if you get the book, I would recommend, I have the paperback for sale, and it's for sale on Amazon. I have it for sale on my website. It'd be a good way to support the podcast. But if you really want to be entertained, get the Kindle version. I make a little bit of money off that, much less. Get the Kindle version because I was able to isolate all the wiretaps that were taken in this investigation of skimming from Las Vegas casinos. I used the transcripts and explained what they were talking about, and then at each transcript in the book, in the Kindle version, you can hit a link and go right to a Vimeo site that contains the actual audio from that wiretap, so you can listen to the actual voices of the men who are skimming from Las Vegas casinos. I have over 200 free back episodes of Gangland Wire for your listening pleasure. And finally, don't forget about the Kansas City Mob Tour app and the Apple Store App Store. Good night, wiretappers.
Music provided by our good friend and superfan from Portland, Oregon, Casey McBride. Thanks, Casey.